From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, we take a look at a federal plan to save an endangered bird that once called the San Francisco Bay home.
Clapper rails used to be so numerous that there are accounts of restaurants serving clapper rails. Clearly, that's not the case anymore.
Then we talk with a local writer about how economic diversity can sustain the places we call home.
Cities with an enormous income disparity are unstable. That looms over San Francisco as a question. How will we deal with the class divide?
And we head to the edge of the map to learn the story behind this week's audiograph sound.
East Bay, we call it. It's about the furthest you get on East Conococcus County.
We're taking you into uncharted territory today on Cross Currents. It's rush hour, and a lot of you might be listening to me right now from the freeway. Maybe you're moving slowly past the Oakland Airport or SFO. If you're snaking your way along 101, look out the window. Can you see AT&T Park? If so, you're actually right on top of land that was once part of the San Francisco Bay. Before the gold rush, the San Francisco Bay Area was a thriving estuary, an ecosystem of interconnecting marshes filled with thousands of species of plants and animals. After San Francisco became a boom town, these tidal marshes began to disappear. They were filled in to make space for housing and industry. More homes for people meant fewer homes for wildlife. Today, less than 10% of the original 200,000 acres of wetlands remain. This month, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service finalized plans to restore some of the natural habitats of the San Francisco Bay tidal marshes. The 50-year billion-dollar project is the biggest marsh restoration project in America outside of the Florida Everglades. It centers on giving six endangered species another chance. KALW's Angela Johnston takes us on a search for a tiny bird whose survival embodies the challenges of restoring the bay.
The California clapper rail is a bird that likes to be heard but not seen.
We typically can't see our birds because they're hiding in the marsh vegetation.
This morning, they aren't too vocal. So to find them, Vivian Bowie scans the air with a big metal antenna attached to a receiver while she listens through headphones.
So we currently have two California clapper rails with radio transmitters attached to them, and each bird has a different frequency. So we have a receiver and other gear that we go out to and listen for their signal, and we bring with us a compass and a GPS so we can get the compass bearings and triangulate their locations.
This process is called telemetry. The closer the birds are, the louder the beeping. Bowie works for the United States Geological Survey. For the past 3 years, she's been researching the clapper rail's every move.
We can study where they like to go at high tide, at low tide, at different times of the day.
The clapper rail is tiny, about the size of your fist. It's brown and orange, has a big yellow beak, and if you're lucky enough to see one, Bowie says they're pretty cute.
I think they're adorable. Not scientific at all. But they're very photogenic. I can say that.
What does the call sound like?
Laughing, I think.
It's this laughing, rattling, clapping bird call that gives the clapper rail its name. No joke, a group of clapper rails is actually called an applause. And it does sound a bit like they're laughing at something. If we were to hear it, it would sound like this. Here at Arrowhead Marsh in Oakland, in a tiny pocket of marshland squeezed between Highway 880 and the Oakland Airport, there are over 80 California clapper rails, hiding in between tall grass. But that number is nothing compared to the amount that used to make marshes like this one their home.
Like, clapper rails used to be so numerous that there are accounts of restaurants serving clapper rails on their menus. That's how many there were.
That was back in the early 1800s, when a clapper rail was served with a baked potato. After nearly being hunted to extinction, the extensive filling and diking of the bay destroyed most of the rail's salt marsh habitat.
California clapperills used to range from Humboldt Bay down to Morro Bay. A lot of tidal salt marsh that used to be here in California has disappeared, and so just most of what's left is here in the San Francisco Bay.
Since the 70s, a few state and federal programs tried to bring the rail population back to historic numbers. At one point, there were only 200 of them. Now the population hovers around 1,000. The rail's recovery is part of a billion-dollar federal plan to protect animals and plants like the salt marsh bird's beak, the salt marsh harvest mouse,
Sassoon thistle, soft bird's beak, and California sea blight, and finally remove them from the list of endangered species.
Valerie Bloom helped write this 50-year restoration plan. Bloom works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I meet up with her during one of her field visits at a large marsh called Cullinan Ranch, just outside of Vallejo.
Okay, so we are, let's see, we're looking north off of Highway 37. So this is, we are right in the heart of a very unique ecosystem in California.
Cullinan Ranch is just one pocket of marshland included in the plan. The restoration also targets 500 miles of other wetlands, stretching from Arcata Bay near Eureka all the way down to Morro Bay near San Luis Obispo. But the majority of the plan centers around the San Francisco Bay, the San Pablo Bay, and the Sassoon Bay. And like most things in San Francisco, it comes with a hefty price tag.
$1.2 billion. It's pricey. Work in the bay is going to cost.
A huge price. But Bloom stresses that this isn't any additional tax money. It's funds that were already available, and it's organizations like hers that were tasked with divvying it up. They thought the marsh was one of the best areas to invest in because it's all interconnected. You see, in the past, marshes were regarded as wastelands, places for new subdivisions, highways, and airports. And the land has been overlooked.
They serve a very important purpose. They're really critical for flood protection.
Marshes also filter contaminants, make our water cleaner, and improve our air quality.
So is it worth it? Yes. For this situation, I think it's within reach. It won't be easy, and it's not going to be immediately, but I think we can recover this ecosystem.
Back at Arrowhead Marsh in Oakland, a group of students are cleaning up trash from the levees. The water is filled with pieces of styrofoam, broken glass bottles, even needles.
I collected 3 bags of garbage from all over the rocks, and we're saving the clapperware. Yeah.
That's Shay Ottaviano. She's 7 years old. She's been learning about the clapperrail habitat at Arrowhead for a while now, and she came out here today in hopes of seeing one.
They just leave the trash all around. And it's not nice to the, and it's being like mean to the birds. If the bird eats the rubber, it will get stuck in their belly, and that will not make them feel good, and then they'll get sick.
Finally, Vivian Bowie spots a clapperrail.
So on this side, if you go down the rocks.
Oh, so it's that. So it's the big guy like preening right there.
Yeah.
Sort of. It's really close to shore, perched on a rock and ruffling its brown feathers. Vivian Bowie looks on, pleased.
How a clapperrail population is doing is indicative of how the marsh is doing overall.
And if the marsh is healthy, it won't only support the clapperrail or the harvest mouse, but also the larger ecosystem that we're all a part of. In Oakland, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
If you'd like to see the clapper rail for yourself, head to our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba.
sometimes looking backwards is the best way forward. Lessons from the past can teach us how to thrive in the future. Local author Anna Lee Newitt says San Francisco's future is something we should start trying to protect right now. Newitt describes her book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, as an optimistic book about extinction. In it, she looks at how humans could deal with a catastrophe along the lines of what killed the dinosaurs. She says one thing we need is strong, resilient cities, and that San Francisco is a model for the world. In this interview from our archives, KALW's Casey Miner spoke with Newitz about adaptation, innovation, and what we can learn from the time local developers almost turned the bay into a landfill.
This was a real plan. This was what the city was going to do. They were going to fill the bay with landfill and cover it with houses because, just like now, there was a housing crunch. We needed room. They had already successfully used landfill to build out the marina, so we knew it could be done. And so why not? And conservation groups managed to organize partly by partnering with industrialists. And today you might compare that to, say, partnering with Google or some other very wealthy company in the area. So they partnered with industrialists, they lobbied politicians, they helped create grassroots organizations in the city to protest doing this. And as a result, we kept our bay. And that bay is now an incredible treasure trove of information for scientists about how to prevent climate change. It's interesting that not only is it, of course, a lovely example of building ecology and environmental concerns into a city, but also what we found in the last 10 years is that a lot of the bacteria living in the wetlands around the bay actually are incredibly great carbon sinks. And that's, of course, what we want to do. We want to get carbon out of the atmosphere and back down into the earth. And so there's a lot of scientists at Berkeley now who are studying this thankfully preserved area, looking for clues about, hey, could we use what we're learning from these bacteria to actually help draw carbon down out of the environment? So it's kind of had this long-term beneficial effect for both the people in the city and scientists. And I think that idea of combining city development with environmental concerns is very futuristic. Maybe we haven't done perfectly here in San Francisco, but we're certainly on the right path. And if you want to look at what's caused mass extinctions in the past and what may be causing one, you know, coming down the pike in the future, it's pretty much always been climate change. And here in the Bay Area, we have an incredibly thriving group of people innovating around green technologies and trying to think about how do we have more efficient solar cells? How can we create generators for solar fuel? How can we create better high-performance windows? How can we build our cities to behave more like a living organism and not have a carbon footprint that is any different from the actual environment around us? So I think that's another thing that makes the city particularly ripe for surviving into the future, as long as we don't sink into the water or have a catastrophic earthquake from which we can't recover.
We're speaking with Anna Lee Newitz. She's the author of the new book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, and you're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Casey Miner. So, you know, we were talking about San Francisco as a hub for innovation and all these ideas, and it's also a place that a lot of people are having to leave for basically exactly that reason. And in the book, one of the things you mention is actually that historically cities tend to collapse when people don't have a certain amount of economic mobility and they have to go elsewhere. And so it was interesting for me to think of San Francisco as a blueprint for the future, because on the one hand, it has all these characteristics that set it up really well for that future. But on the other hand, there is a certain amount of stagnation happening right now.
I'll say a few things to that. First of all, it is true that cities with an enormous income disparity are unstable. That looms over San Francisco as a question. How will we deal with the class divide? As we're looking toward the future, we need to be thinking about what kinds of basic services we think should belong to everyone. And right now, we're all pretty happy with the idea that, like, well, no matter how poor you are, you shouldn't be deprived of heat and water and, you know, hopefully food. But although people seem a little confused about whether the poor actually need food, which is a little puzzling to me. But I think going forward, we need to start thinking about the fact that everyone should have a right to
their own energy source. So as we start thinking more about solar or biofuel, thinking about people being able to do that, be living off the grid, essentially. We also need to start thinking about access to the information infrastructure. I was talking a lot before about how San Francisco is so great because we have all this science and technology that's being developed here. And then we also have neighborhoods where people have horrifically bad internet access or no internet access at all. And I think San Francisco really needs to be thinking about the idea that having access to that information should be a right for everyone. I think any sane plan for the future of our city has to take into account that we need to be making room, both technologically, but also just in terms of physical room for people from many different backgrounds, income backgrounds, but also for immigrants and, you know, people who have historically been kind of booted out of the city.
Say you were going to take San Francisco and you got to do whatever you wanted with San Francisco to make it a resilient city for the future. What would you change and why?
That is a really good question. If I were in charge of San Francisco, you know, there's a couple things that I would do. I think one of the really kind of bright lights in San Francisco's future, if it happens, is this idea of creating a transit hub downtown where we limit the number of cars that are available, but at the same time, beef up our public transportation enough that we make up for the loss of those cars. And if that can really work, I think that is exactly what I would hope for the future of the city. And I'd like to see more of that being done. And part of the thing that's really hopeful to me about that transit plan isn't just the idea of getting more public transit, which is, of course, crucial, but the fact that it also includes high-density housing. And I think in San Francisco, we have always been kind of weirded out by high density housing. You know, we like our pretty city. We like the idea of things being kind of no more than three stories high, except really right downtown in the financial district. And that has to change because the most sustainable way of living is to put a lot of people in one place where you can scale up the need for resources like electricity or water in a way that's much more cost effective. And it allows you to use a much smaller number of resources to get people the energy that they need, for example. So really, San Francisco of the future is going to have some megastructures in it. And the good news is that megastructures actually deal really well with earthquakes because you can build them to sway, which sounds terrifying, but is actually, in terms of engineering, really great. It means that the building kind of bends with the movement of the earth. That's what you want to have happen. And so I hope that our city can grow taller. I would really like our city to be totally carbon neutral. Imagine in the future these huge tall buildings that are fueled by solar or fueled by biofuels, solar fuels, whatever we wind up using, and where people are able to live in close proximity, but also because we have such high density, they can also enjoy things like public parks and public transit that takes them to places where they're not crammed into a building, because I know not everybody thinks that's the most awesome idea. Hopefully that would look beautiful. I can imagine lots of ways that it could go wrong, but I can also imagine a lot of ways where you could have just beautiful soaring buildings that are covered in solar panels and that that are covered in even gardens and plants. And I think that would be kind of where I'd want to see the city going.
Writer Anna Lee Newitz is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. She spoke with KALW's Casey Miner. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. For the past several weeks, we've been taking you to the confluence of two rivers. It's part of our series, Navigating the Delta, that brings you stories from the waterways that flow to the San Francisco Bay. Only about an hour's drive east of San Francisco, right in the middle of the Delta, is Bethel Island. It's tiny, only 5 square miles, and you have to cross a bridge or use a boat to get there.
There's no traffic light, no grocery store, no school, but a few thousand people call it home. One of those people is KALW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum. She's the third generation in her family to live on the island. She got on the water with her dad to bring us the answer to this week's audiograph.
Stroke.
Carl Krigbaum, Ashley Ann's dad, and we're on Bethel Island, out in the Delta.
This is really special. I've never had a tour by my dad before of the water. So from these waterways, from right here, we could get to the bay, we could go up the river to Sacramento, you can go
Sacramento,
everywhere.
Sacramento, go up to Stockton. Just about the furthest you can get on East Contra Costa County. Growing up out here, I could have went anywhere on the island I wanted to go, as long as I didn't go over the bridge. Dad was fine with that. We lived right down in the main part of town, and the only time you see any cars go by is a few people that went to the post office, because they don't deliver mail to the houses out here.
But you've got the people in the morning at coffee.
Yeah, well, it's like any little town, you know. You got your little morning coffee shop, and locals go and complain about everything, make big decisions. No, it's nice, quiet and peaceful. There's a couple of islands don't have hardly any house at all on it. A couple of farmhouses and a few trees, nice and green levees. And the other side, there's another island with boats and houses on it all the way around almost. Well, how'd you like your ride?
That was awesome. Thanks, Dad.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Mr. Krigbaum. Well, none of you guessed the answer to this week's sound, but don't worry. You'll have another chance to test your knowledge of the Bay Area's sounds next week. Here's a sneak peek.
Okay. Timers, are you all set to zero?
Yep.
Yes. Brunos, listos? Unos, dos, vamonos!
So, think you know what that was and where we recorded it? Well, if you've been listening closely to Audiograph over the past year, you just might already know the answer. Give us a call and tell us what you think. Our number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that's it for today's Cross Currents. Our team includes Leela Day, Maya DePaola Hanica, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Christina Loring, Ryan Miller, Seth Samuel, Julia Scott, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show is produced by Julie Kane and engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported public radio. This is musician Myra Melford. She says she continually reaches toward a state of transcendence with her music, yet there's always a connection to the Chicago blues traditions she heard growing up. Myra Melford plays this Saturday night at the SF Jazz Center. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.